check in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Welcome to Thursday afternoon on 720 WGN. We're going to jump right into it before Mark Zuckerberg loses even more money. On the phone line is Ian Schur. He is a senior editor at CNET.com and joins us on most Thursdays. Very flexible today, Ian. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Facebook has weathered just about every storm you can imagine, and yesterday they were out with some numbers when it comes to users that wasn't quite as big an increase as people were expecting, and lo and behold, Mark Zuckerberg has lost something like $18 billion in his personal fortune today, at least when you look at Wall Street, right? What's going on there?
Well, what's going on is that there are a couple of things. First is that the law of large numbers is starting to hit them. We're getting to a point now where it may not seem like it's possible, but actually the number of people who have a Facebook account in the United States and in Europe and a lot of the world, the people who want one largely have one.
So the growing number of users... I'm sorry, and we did a story earlier this week about how birth rates are declining. What you're telling me is that we need birth rates to increase so Mark can have more users.
Right. I mean, look, about more than half of the world's online population is using Facebook, and it seems as though maybe that's about the maximum that he's going to get for now. And until then, you know, the number of growing users was helping to make Wall Street say, oh, well, the more users means more eyeballs to look at more ads. So it's they all felt great about it. But if we are seeing a drop in the number of users, on top of all of the money that Mark Zuckerberg is spending trying to stamp out fake news and conspiracy theories and hateful stuff that happens on the site, which means hiring a bunch of people to help moderate the website and make sure bad stuff isn't happening, all of that costs money. And so all of that together really looks bad for them today.
The stock is down 19% today, down 41, 42 is when it looks at points, but down 19%. So is this all of a sudden an emperor has no clothing moment, or is this going to be looked at as a blip and something that they will overcome?
I think Theranos is an emperor who has no clothing, right? That was an actual fraud. This one is more of an issue of, you know, what is the future of Facebook? Is it going to be the pervasive thing that is in all of our lives, or is it going to be a thing that's on the internet? And for a while, I think that Wall Street traders and a lot of people were betting that Facebook was going to become just bigger and bigger, bigger all the time. And now that we're learning that maybe it won't, people's expectations are getting changed. And on top of that, again, there's all of this fake news and false conspiracy theories and hateful stuff that happens that Facebook still has not been able to get its hand wrapped around.
We're still
talking about Alex Jones and InfoWars and all that stuff.
Right. I was going to say, they say they've got a strategy, but it's kind of murky as to just exactly what it is.
Well, and, you know, part of that is they don't want to share with us everything because then the people that they're trying to fight learn, right? But there's definitely a problem of communication. We don't know what they're doing. It doesn't look like they're doing enough to a lot of people. And they are opening themselves up to criticism left, right, and center. And that's causing, I mean, I don't know if you heard, there was news out yesterday that Sheryl Sandberg, the COO, and Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, are going to be hauled before Capitol Hill, the Intelligence Committee, right? This is not minor stuff that's going on there.
I did see that, and I wanted to ask you about that. What's bringing them back, and what does the Intelligence Committee expect to hear from them?
You know, it's all a little bit unclear, but I'm willing to step out on a ledge and believe that this is continued conversation about the way that Russians interfered in the elections. Remember that we've got the midterms popping up soon, and this hearing, according to news reports, is happening in September, which is just a couple months before the midterms. And on top of that, there is still continued concern. I mean, I feel like every couple weeks, there's a hearing on Capitol Hill where there's either a discussion about Russian meddling all over the internet, or there's discussion about how conservative voices are being silenced on Facebook and Twitter and the concerns around that. And these things need to be solved, whether or not, however you fall on the political spectrum, the fact that government is spending a lot of time debating this means something needs to happen.
That's Ian Schur, senior editor at CNET.com. We're going to take a break and come back with Ian, and he's going to explain to me how a new gizmo from Google, the Titan Key, might have saved the Democratic National Committee from being hacked. Maybe not, but that's coming up.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Ian Schur's on a phone line. He's the senior editor at CNET.com. All right, Ian, we were talking earlier on the show, or on the this week, I should say, about this piece of hardware. I think it's called Winston, where you can plug it in, and it will sort of hide your location and scramble your emails and all of that, take care of it. It's a piece of hardware. I really hadn't heard of anything like that. And now I'm reading and seeing it about Google's Titan Key, which is just another version of some stuff that's already out there. But I did not know about this sort of key technology. Explain it to me.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff out there that if you are willing to step up your efforts, you can protect yourself pretty well on the internet. And this thing is actually developed by Google. They boasted, by the way, that none of its 85,000 employees had had their accounts hacked since early 2017 because of this technology. And what it is that you may remember that if you set up it with your bank, or with some of you may have set it up with your email, that when you try to log in, it sends you a code to your text message.
Correct.
And you have to enter it in. Well, this actually makes it so that you don't have to do that. Instead, you have a little key that you keep in your pocket that you either plug into the computer, or you press a little button and it talks to an app. And what it'll do is create a code automatically using special computer programs that will make sure that you are you and logs you in. And if you don't have it, you can't log in.
It's like having a key to your car that you don't have to put in the ignition, right? If it's in your pocket, it sends a signal. Okay. And so will this Google key, this Titan key, will it work only for Gmail, or it works for the entire computer and any email sources or anything like that?
So they've designed it to work with other things. Right now, I believe it only works with Facebook and Google. By the way, it's also not cheap. It's $50 for both for two keys, or you can buy one key for $20 to $25.
Okay.
And it's designed to be used for many systems. And by the way, Google has been trying to do this for a while. They have a software, a little app called Google Authenticator that they've offered for years that works with all sorts of different websites.
Okay, but if I
so
buy
this, will probably grow out to that too.
But not right now. So if I'm using Outlook at home and I put the $50 down for this Titan key, it's not necessarily going to help me.
Well, that is up to your employer. That's part of the problem.
Sure,
and
right,
this is where security really starts to fall down, is if your IT department has not implemented these types of security measures, then it's not going to help you. Right? It's up to them to do these things.
And I was going
to
say, then still you could get into my computer, go through my files, but I guess you're only doing that through email for the most part. And so if you protect the email system, then you should be okay.
Right. And I mean, in the future, a lot of the experts say that eventually everything's going to get tied together really well. But right now, getting everyone on the same page security-wise is incredibly tough. There are like 1,500 companies out there that are offering something or another, as you pointed out. And so it's about making sure that we figure out which one is best, which one do we trust, and getting everyone to use it.
And the other thing, though, is if I have my fob and I leave it at work and I go home and try to log onto my computer and I'm fobless,
out of luck.
I might be, that's a bad thing.
Okay. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, exactly. That's the tough part, right? It requires a different way of thinking. But hey, if you left your car key at the bar and tried to walk over to your car, what happens, right? So we have to just start thinking like this.
All right, so there's that. We've just got less than a minute, but tell me about Samsung's unbreakable smartphone screen. I think we've talked about foldable phones coming back with one screen, but this looks like a big step toward that.
Yeah, and this is really fascinating. Samsung tends to announce new technology right before they announce a new phone. We're expecting a new phone in the next couple of weeks. So this is supposedly able to take a number of drops from hip height. It's something like 24 drops without breaking, which is just unbelievable.
That's like 2 weeks
for me. Yeah, I mean, look, the technology I've heard of before, the best out there was like 4 or 5 drops from hip height. So this is a huge step forward. We'll see whether it works. Saying that it's quote-unquote unbreakable is a very, very strong claim. I'm curious to see how it'll play out. We're definitely going to put it through its paces on CNET. But it's really real. It's going to be a huge step forward. It's going to make a lot of difference for a lot of people.
Ian Schur, senior editor at CNET.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll do it again next week.
My pleasure.
Now, your noontime check in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is 1:36. A little bit later in this half hour, we're going to talk travel. And the generational travel, really, how it's different for Gen Xers or millennials and then baby boomers. We'll talk to an expert from Ipsos Polls. They looked at that. They looked at some of the numbers and trying to figure out how travel companies can market to future clients. So that's a little bit later, but we're going to start with soybeans. Ben Sasse, the Republican senator from Nebraska, said this: this administration's tariffs and bailouts aren't going to make America great again. They're going to make it 1929 again. The president is in Illinois today. He'll be in downstate Granite City at a U.S. steel plant to talk about the increased steel production at that facility because of the tariffs on steel and aluminum. They like it there. I don't think the soybean growers of Illinois have the same enthusiasm. Lynn Reuscheib is on a phone line. She is the chairwoman of the Illinois Soybean Growers. Lynn, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Absolutely. Are you a farmer, Lynn?
I am.
Where's
I'm a farmer
farm?
In downstate Illinois, over by Champaign in Vermilion County. I'm about a half hour east of Champaign.
That's Watseka, right? Is the seat of Vermilion County. Did I get that right?
Watseka
no, that's
is
Iroquois.
Actually north in Iroquois,
yeah,
but
Iroquois.
You've got the right vicinity in the state, though.
I was reading in some of your literature that there are 43,000 soybean growers in Illinois. How can that be?
There are. We're a very long state, and when you get to the a little bit farther south, so in the mid part of the state, there's just a lot of us farmers out there throughout the state.
I didn't realize. I wouldn't have guessed the number was that big. I'm a Kankakee County boy, so I get some of
this.
Okay, so I want you to talk us through a lot of what's been going on, because sometimes it becomes noise and it's not altogether understandable. Illinois farmers, by one estimate, could lose, what, $420 million as a result of these tariffs. Is that an accurate number?
Yes, it could be around that, yes.
And is that forever, or is that this year, or how does that number work?
Oh, gosh, I hope that's not a forever thing every year. But, yeah, it could be an annual number on there. And that how they come about that number is that it's not just the soybean farmer. It's also the different crushing facilities that are also making soybean meal for the livestock industry, and then all biodiesel, and then vegetable oils, and a few other industries that the soybean industry does also impact on, such as the pork industry as well. So it's got a wide scope of things, but yes, it is a large number, and it's kind of a scary number when you're a farmer and you're kind of looking through as to how you're going to make things meet and be profitable for the coming year and years ahead.
Illinois exports more soybeans to China than any other state?
That is correct.
Okay, so then here we are. What has happened to the price of Illinois soybeans, soybean growers in Illinois, the price since these tariffs were announced?
Yeah, so unfortunately, since these tariffs have been announced, and even when it was talked about, our soybean farmers have lost about $2 in revenue per bushel, and that's not taking it off of our net numbers. That's off of our gross. So, and basically now we are under the cost of production, so we are losing money now. For a soybean farmer, it's the break-even point is $10 a bushel, and we are very close to that $8 mark right now. It kind of keeps teetering back and forth. But in Illinois, I think yesterday I saw it was around $8.25, $8.30. So, I mean, we are under what we're losing money. We're under what it costs us to produce a bushel of soybeans now. So we're very heavily trying to figure out what things we need to cut back on and what things are definitely the necessities that we need to make sure that our family farms are still going to be functioning the year and years ahead.
All right, a couple of developments this week then from the White House, and I want to ask you about each of them. The first was his announcement yesterday about working toward a resolution with the EU and selling more soybeans to the European Union. I don't know how many soybeans you sell to the European Union, but I would imagine that wasn't bad news. How good of a news story was it for you? I mean, what do you expect to come out of that?
Well, expanding any market as a soybean farmer, and especially in times like these, makes me very excited and very happy, because now there's another avenue that could be available for our soybeans to go to, since our number one supplier has has these tariffs and is backing off as to how much of our soybeans that they're purchasing. Right now, Europe buys some soybeans from us, but it's not a huge amount. But like I said, we're pretty optimistic and look forward to a continued increase in their interest in our soybeans.
So, but it's sort of like putting a Band-Aid on a cut when you've got a gaping wound on another part of your body, right? China's the big deal.
That's correct. And, you know, not one single market is going to be able to heal the, as you put it, with the wound, is going to be able to heal that market with China. With the case of Illinois, 60% of the soybeans that are grown each year in the state of Illinois are exported. And out of that 60%, China is 25% of that, and they are our number one customer. So even if a lot of our other markets start to increase that we have currently, they're not going to meet that whole amount that China is. So we're aggressively looking at different products or different countries and ways that we can try to open up some more markets or to have our current customers to purchase more soybeans from us.
Lynn, so then the other thing that happened was this $12 billion aid package that is being sent out. You guys are out with a statement saying that handouts are a poor solution. I don't imagine you'll turn it away, but why is it that you think that should not have been done?
Well, there's several factors to that, but basically the simplest explanation is that it sounds like $12 billion is a lot of money, but when you take it throughout all of the aspects of agriculture that have been hit and affected by these tariffs, it's not going to be enough, and we're going to have to apply as farmers for how much of this money we are going to get. They're still working on all of the actual specifics and the rules and regulations that are going to follow with this, but in ways in the past, it's going to be, there's going to be winners and losers in this, and it's not going to, probably in my own case with my own family's farming operation, I mean, we're just in soybeans alone, we're losing $600,000 in revenue. And that's not a net, that's a gross that we're losing off the top that, you know, we weren't, that we had thought we were going to have. And I'm fairly sure, I can't speak for this because I don't know how exactly all this aid's going to be written, but right. I highly doubt that the four members of my family's farming operation that we're going to be able to recoup $600,000 from aid, because there's so many other segments of the farming community. But by the time that you go through cotton and corn and right. soybeans, and the dairy industry is hurting, it's hit the pork producers very hard, which hits a soybean farmer double. It's a Band-Aid to the situation. And I myself, as a farmer, I don't want to take aid from taxpayers. I want to be able to raise my crop and then to be able to sell it at a fair price and to be able to expand agricultural markets and other ag opportunities in other countries.
Lynn, as a taxpayer, I don't want to give you aid. I want you to sell your beans to China, too. If you take all the farmers in the country by one count and divide it by that $12 billion, it comes to something like $4,000. Which certainly wouldn't cut it when it comes to helping out. I'm out of time. I'm very grateful that you joined us. I hope we can talk again, maybe when the news is better, but even if it's not, let's check in again later, okay?
Sounds good. I look forward to it. Thank you.
You bet. Lynn Rorscheib is the chairwoman of the Illinois Soybean Growers Association. We'll check the numbers and then go traveling on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Holy cow, that was unexpected. Let's talk about Grubhub real quick. After reporting earnings yesterday, the Chicago-based company noted massive jumps in sales, spiking the stock price up 24% and increasing the company value to $12.5 billion. they are just doing everything right, keeping customers in the loop and integrating the larger old-school restaurants that might be struggling to keep up with the times. That's exactly how they're doing it. Oh yeah, they also acquired this little mobile loyalty app called Level Up for nearly $390 million. But as a whole, I think it's safe to say Chicago is leveling up itself by continually looking to the future. And so is 1871, as they're discussing today the future of cloud technology. The company Red Hat is hosting a panel to sort through the changing space of cloud-native integration. Alright, fine, it may seem like a talk that would go right over most people's heads, but this is going to be basic stuff 10 years down the road. So why not start chipping away and understanding it now? It's happening today until 6 p.m. at the 1871 Auditorium. So check it out. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are at 12:54. We're going to get right to Tony in Calcaterra is on the phone line. He is the Chief Research Officer at Ipsos Affluent Intelligence, and they're looking at travel these days. Tony, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, so the way I explained it earlier is you do surveys, you do research that then you bring to businesses to help them find their clients, right, or to reach their clients. Tell me about Ipsos. Yes.
So Ipsos is a full-service research company. The group within Ipsos that I work on specifically looks at affluent adults, and we describe affluence in the United States currently as people living in households that have a household income of at least $125,000 a year.
And so you looked at them when it comes to travel, and we just have a couple of minutes, I'm sorry to say,
sure.
But tell me about that. Millennial women are the drivers here, it sounds like.
They absolutely are, and it's quite interesting because we're often used to looking at things generationally and talk about millennials as if they're a homogenous unit.
Right.
But what we're really finding, especially in travel, is that women millennials are taking the lead, and that male millennials are often sort of the followers, the next
Wait,
in line.
Are you telling me that's not the same for every generation, Tony?
Well, you know, it's very funny. When it comes to travel, there are just certain things where women are going to take the lead, particularly in planning. And we do see this quite a bit. In terms of the millennials, though, what we're finding is that it's not just the planning that women are taking charge of, but that they're actually seeking very different things from millennial men. What we're also seeing is that as they get older and as kids start to enter the picture, then they shift more of that responsibility to men to take charge of some of that planning, which likely means that they've got their hands full with the kids.
I also like to think it's interesting, though, that the younger they are, perhaps the younger, I'm not sure, but millennials and Gen Xers are more interested in going somewhere undiscovered, maybe, or unusual. But by the time you get to be a baby boomer or elderly, you've already made your discoveries in life. You want to go to what's a little more comfortable, or you're not worried about being the first one in one particular spot. You've already proven that. You don't have to prove that now.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. What we do find with the millennials in particular is that they are really trying to experience things in a different fashion. As you said, they're young. They haven't really had that taste yet, and they want to see and try new experiences. It's all about the experience more than it is about the physical things.
And it's all about food in many ways too, right? It's all about taste.
It is. Millennials in particular, despite their young age, they are probably the toughest customers when it comes to food.
Tony in Calcaterra, yep. Chief Research Officer at Ipsos. I'm sorry, Tony, we didn't have more time, but I hope we can talk
That's
again.
Quite all right. My pleasure. You guys have a great day.
All right, you too. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.